With that, I'd like to introduce the last speaker in the session, James Rudd, who will be the discussant for FDG PET imaging.
Thank you very much. Could I have the next slide, please? Thanks very much, and thank you to the organizers for the invitation to speak today. I can see that there aren't too many left, and I certainly took the instructions to talk for 5 minutes with five slides literally, so hopefully we'll be able to wrap this up before 7 p.m. I'm just going to put into context a little bit of what Ahmed has said. I have no relevant disclosures here. And just really bring this back to, I think, what JC mentioned, Jean-Claude Tardif, in his in the initial talk, some of the benefits of imaging biomarkers and then how FDG PET stacks up against those benefits. He made the point that if we use imaging, we can end up, hopefully, with a smaller number of patients within the study, shorter clinical trials, and therefore cheaper clinical trials. And this is really because every single subject enrolled in an imaging study who completes the study does contribute an endpoint to the study, as opposed to a traditional phase 3, phase 4 study, when only a small percentage of subjects will actually have an adverse endpoint, which we can count in a drug study. Secondly, as we were just discussing on the final question posed to Dr. Tawakol, we can use imaging to enrich trial recruitment, both in terms of recruiting patients we think are especially likely to respond to therapy, and also excluding those subjects who we think are very unlikely to respond to therapy. And imaging is very useful for that. Again, it can help us to bridge that gap between phase 2 and phase 3 studies. Although, of course, it's not the only thing that we take into consideration, a strongly positive or a strongly negative study can be an important determinant as to whether a molecule moves forward to phase 3, phase 4 studies. And similarly, and I put this fourth and last for a good reason, we, of course, need randomized, controlled phase 3, phase 4 studies to provide data on safety and clinical endpoints. But certainly, if an imaging study reports adverse events in terms of, for example, pro-inflammatory effect in when we are talking about FDG PET, then that is generally a bad thing and would certainly raise flags in a larger clinical study. So when it comes to PET, we're really, as Ahmed said, talking about FDG PET. The signal, we do believe, correlates pretty well with the degree of inflammation in the arterial wall, and Ahmed has presented the evidence for this. Multi-center studies are certainly possible. We've reported a couple in the UK, several more in the manuscript writing phase in the US. It's possible, again, as Robin Chowdhury pointed out, you do need very good training of sites and very clearly and explicitly written protocols for the imaging side of things, but this is certainly possible and has been performed successfully recently. We can measure the change in FDG uptake with therapy, and we can exclude a lack of pro-inflammatory effect, for example, as we saw in the dalcetrapib study, and of course we can measure efficacy, as has been shown in the statin studies. Coronary artery imaging, to get back to the question of whether we need to image the artery where the action is happening, if you like, or whether we can image the aorta and the carotids, as we do mainly in FDG studies, coronary imaging is very tricky. And Ahmed showed a couple of slides, and he's been the pioneer in this area. But the problem is the myocardial muscle itself is an avid accumulator of FDG, and this tends to spill over and make assessment of coronary artery plaque uptake of FDG very tricky. The other issue, of course, is that the heart is constantly beating and the chest is moving with respiration. And again, given the resolution of PET, this makes things very difficult indeed. So I would have to conclude at the moment that I think this is impractical using FDG. What are we going to see in the future that's going to help this field, help pharma companies to make these critical decisions? Well, PET-MR integration is certainly the thing, to my mind, that strikes me as the most likely to give us rich dividends. We have the multi-contrast nature of MR that Robin Chowdhury has demonstrated so nicely. And, of course, we also have the added benefit of excluding CT and reducing the radiation dose to the patient. We're also, if we move away from FDG just for a second, there are as was shown on one of the slides before, several other areas of plaque biology which are really ripe for imaging. And some of the new classes of drugs are going to be targeted not necessarily against lipid biomarkers, but perhaps against calcification, hypoxia, and other adverse pathological processes within the plaque. There's been some recent work published by myself and colleagues in Edinburgh evaluating a trace of sodium fluoride, which is, we believe, targeted against dynamic active calcification within the plaque. And this can give very nice results in the coronary arteries where there's no myocardial uptake whatsoever. Hypoxia is another process which is being addressed in ongoing, very, very early phase one studies. Angiogenesis can be tracked quite nicely using PET. Again, small center studies right now, but looking forward 2 to 5 years, I think this is going to be very useful as a marker of disease activity. Inflammation, more specific markers of inflammation than FDG are certainly out there. They haven't really hit the headlines very much, except a single marker called PK11195, which has been used by Paolo Camici's group in London and in Milan to track a regression of inflammation in patients with vasculitis treated with steroids. And finally, apoptosis is another area of atherosclerosis biology ripe for imaging biomarkers. And again, there's a PET tracer and, of course, MR tracer against this. I'm actually going to finish there. I do have some other slides which I could show if there's interest concerning those newer tracers, but I thought it'd be useful to finish there and take perhaps a panel discussion. So I'm going to thank my funding bodies and collaborators, and I'm happy to take questions and hand back to Ahmed.
I'd like to invite the panel to a discussion and try to synthesize some ideas of what we've heard today and what we should be doing down the line. Maybe I can start with Rob Scott and get some industry perspectives.
Thanks, Ahmed. And before I say anything, let me just say that I'm an enthusiastic supporter of imaging. I've used it in the past to good effect, but in the words of another well-known imaging person, what I'm going to say next is tough love. And part of the problem is that imaging hasn't performed that well in the recent past. It didn't help with the torcetrapib program. It wasn't very helpful with the ezetimibe story, and it hasn't given definitive answers with the darolutamide program. So, you know, it's not easy. It's not short. It's not cheap. It's often not definitive. And so I don't think it's going to be useful in phase two, for instance, for dose selection. So you just have to recognize it's quite hard to get funding for imaging nowadays. Thank you.
You want to have tissues? It's an interesting point I'll get to after this question.
Well, I'm going to pile it on. So as a funder, many of you alluded to using imaging studies to do risk stratification, and we struggle a bit in making funding decisions in these types of studies because by the time they reach the end of the study, there's some new imaging modality out there. So it's PET today, but what is it going to be in 5 years when the PET results are out and they may or may not show anything at that point in time? And so how can we not be behind the curve, essentially? Clinicians want to know what is the best thing to do. How can we provide them with that information? And I didn't bring any tissues, I'm sorry.
I hope we're always behind the curve because that's the fun of doing it. I mean, that's we're always striving to do better, more sophisticated patient characterization. Sometimes when I feel a little bit despondent about imaging and I find myself tissueless, I reflect on some aspects of medicine where we use imaging to very good effect. So my orthopedic colleagues would not dream of treating every leg trauma with a plaster cast for 3 months in the hope that they'd pick up some that were broken. the fact is that their imaging technique is fantastic. They can pick up fractures and they can direct the treatment appropriately. When I'm in the cath lab late at night and there's an occluded right coronary artery, I can open that artery up. It's an absolutely patient-specific treatment that delivers point of care, relief of symptoms, and removal of risk. I think the point that's come through today is that we just haven't quite got there yet with some of these imaging techniques. We need to catch up with the curve a little bit. We need to keep pushing on. But if we don't keep trying, we don't keep experimenting, we don't keep expanding the vision, then we're not going to get there. It seems to me that there's a real urgency for us to keep on with this, though, because the idea that we can keep treating patients non-discriminately in the way that we have, you know, with aspirin and statin and ACE inhibitors and pick your drug of the last 20 years seems absolutely inconceivable if you look at the list that I showed you on that final slide. Drugs are getting more sophisticated, they're getting more expensive, and it's not in anybody's interest, patients, funders, purchasers, pharma, to pursue this non-discriminate treatment. So I think we must keep going, and I really urge everybody to bear with us until the field is, if you like, caught up with the curve or at least approximated to it.
I don't disagree. I mean, we need some better way to risk stratify. But which trial do we fund? Do we fund the PET CT or the MRI or the PET? What is it going to be? Is the next one. And I don't know. I'm actually looking for wisdom.
Yes, I'm just trying to go back on the focus of this session, which is intitulated Facilitating the Discovery of Effective Therapies. I'm not sure that we should try to catch up, I'd just say, try finding the new, better imaging modality. Earlier on, there was a comment, we're still not sure whether IMT is a good surrogate. Data are still contradicting themselves. So maybe what we need is just to step back and just to evaluate better whether or not any of these techniques that's been evaluated, can be used as a good surrogate before going to the new one. I know it's a little provocative to some of you, but I'd like you to comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, I do think we need, just to get back to Denise's point, we need to distinguish between risk stratifying patients and the focus more of this session, which was using these techniques to tell us whether drugs work or not. I think these are two different questions, sometimes using the same imaging, but fundamentally different questions, and obviously have different requirements for funding.
A comment back to what Rob was mentioning earlier, too, is I think where we get in the greatest trouble is when we start looking at endpoints that were not pre-described as the primary endpoint, where a lot of the times I think it's wishful thinking looking at the secondary and exploratory endpoints, and I think many of those cases where there are misadventures were linked to some of those exploratory endpoints, so perhaps a little more constraint. I think we're going to be able to be a little more restrained going forward because it's easier to start looking at secondary and exploratory endpoints when you have a very new technique. Because very frankly, when you have a new technique, you might not really know up front what your primary endpoint should look like. You might be quite equipoised in terms of choosing between endpoints, and you might really feel halfway through your study that you chose the wrong endpoint. But at this point, as we develop more validation studies, we should be much more constrained and restrained in terms of looking at our primary endpoints, and perhaps we'll have fewer misadventures with miscalculating the potential benefits of treatments.
I think sometimes the problem is not with the imaging technique, but it's the disease under study. So if you look at a patient with a coronary tree and you image different parts of the coronary tree, actually what you see is in some parts of the coronary tree in the same patient, they're progressing, other parts they're regressing. So the amount of variability in individual subjects is really high. And the only way to get around that, I think, is to have a very potent intervention and to have a large sample size. I think that when we're trying to treat patients to reduce clinical endpoints, we're probably never going to be able to pick out the patient who's about to have an endpoint with any technology, because I think every patient is a fertile soil for an endpoint, and they're rolling the dice And the difference between a high-risk patient and a low-risk patient is they're rolling the dice more frequently. So, you know, I think that... So my own philosophy towards imaging is it's a good technology. We can use it. We have to pick the right patients. And then we have to realize it's not going to be cheap or easy or small, but it has a lot of value despite that.
I think the main issue is that it's until when the new, I mean, and the imaging techniques will not show clearly that they are clearly associated with events, and that what we see and modify is associated with events, that cannot be used as an endpoint in regulatory trials, neither phase 2 or phase 3. And so the issue is what you do with it, because it's if you look at lipid lowering, then you have an indication for lipid lowering just based on cholesterol. The other issue is that you, if you want to have a prognostic indication, then you need to have an event study. So, and if you want to do an imaging study, then you still need to have an event study. So what's the added value of that?
You know, if I can hit that one briefly. You are about to gamble $700 million on a phase 3 clinical trial for atherosclerosis, you might be better served to gain additional insights about efficacy with a phase 2 trial beforehand as a gating trial. So I don't see why imaging couldn't be part of a phase 2 strategy. I understand the phase 3. You're not going to be satisfied with an unvalidated marker, and I think the bar is extremely high to go there. But at the same time, our current approach to drug development is highly impaired. We need more insights going forward. We need to choose amongst many potentially promising treatments which ones to take forward.
I believe that the phase 2 should mainly be focused to dose selection. And if you embark with a new technology that is not clearly validated, you don't know what the what you're looking at. So it's then if you have a surrogate, call it a surrogate endpoint, imaging technique, that is clearly associated with events, then, or with a clinically meaningful endpoint, then you can use it. But unless you don't have it, you cannot even use it, because it's you just said, if you come with a new technique and you just come out with a new endpoint, then what's the value of that for the phase 3 implementation?
If I can also add a little bit to that, I mean, when phase 2, one of the most challenging aspects in clinical development, in that we have to choose a dose. And one of the things that I've learned in my time in industry and have been taught very well is that you need to know what your molecule does, and you need to make sure that you understand the biology very well. And so when we choose a dose, it's not just the safety and tolerability, but it's also, are you covering your target? Are you hitting your target? And so one of the, I mean, I think Robin did a beautiful job of really outlining some of the challenges associated with it, with, in particular, MRI. He talked about the heterogeneity within the vascular tree. There are certain areas within the vascular tree that are predisposed to atherothrombosis versus other ones that seem to be protected due to the flow. And then we get into the issue that a lot of our trials are global. And this morning in a diabetes session, we heard about how diabetics present differently in China versus how they present in India. And so when you add all of those issues on to then choosing a dose, it makes it quite, quite challenging. But I do give all of the panelists an incredible amount of credit. I really enjoyed what Dr. Rudd was showing at towards the end, where you were getting towards the targeted, being able to image in a targeted fashion. But I think, as Denise was saying, I think it still needs to evolve, and we need more time before I think imaging is going to be a tool that's going to help us make a go, no-go decision and also choose a dose.
You know, Ahmed, we beat on imaging, and that's fine. That's the right setting to do that. We are here for a lively debate, and we all consider clinical outcomes as the gold standard. But that gold standard, you know, I can think of a lot of program over the last few decades in cardiology where even clinical outcomes did not always really give an easily interpretable answer. So, you know, we beat on imaging fine, but, you know, Eisen's been around for, what, 40 years? And I'm still not sure, and we have someone who led a major program. I'm still not sure what to think about niacin after 40 years. And forget imaging. Just talk about the clinical trials. Let's talk about, for those of you who followed that literature 20 years ago, I remember the Elite 1 and Elite 2 study, both clinical outcomes coming with opposite conclusions. I can think of, Prasugrel working in Triton, not working in Trilogy. I mean, or I could give dozens of examples in clinical. So, I mean, it's fine to beat on imaging, and I think we should do that, and we have a lot of work to do. But even the clinical outcomes are not that simple to interpret, and well, you know, I think we're still puzzled by this 0.05 p-value in the UKPDS study 25 years ago. I mean, there have been more... you know, editorials about that, and, you know, we're still not sure what that means. So, you know, just my editorial comment.
Yeah, but you're just making a good point on the fact that if you have a trial that is positive and then you need a secondary confirmatory trial before approval, unless you have a previous trial that has shown surrogate endpoints going on the same direction. And that is... what we look at when we assess a file. And so if you have a phase three that goes on surrogate endpoints and that goes in the same direction of an event study, then that is an approvable study. But, for example, the examples of the Elite were different because it's there were ad hoc constructed endpoints which were not adequately validated beforehand. And in the way they were presented, and then when they designed the appropriate study, they were proven to be wrong.
Well, glucose lowering, I can think of that's much more than one trial.
Absolutely. And what do we use for approval of drugs? We use A1C, and I think that many people would argue it's not really clear that that's a proven surrogate for clinical outcomes, and the clinical outcome studies are hard to do in people with diabetes. So you're right. I mean, absolutely, we could beat on any.
Someone has a question. Dr. Garcia asked a question. What about if imaging, you know, in that modified trial, you have one imaging endpoint going in one direction, the other one, well, you know, what's that study called where infarcts went down and mortality went up in diabetes? What do you make of that? So, I mean, it's not only about imaging. Someone has said it. Biology is complex, and it's not only about imaging. It's about this business of the human body, and cardiology is complex.
But the problem is, again, that after approvability, then there's reimbursability. So, and if we're going to spend 160 million euro per year on the DPP-4s, which is more or less what we spend in Italy, then we want to be sure that that is an effective treatment that reduces the use of resources. And we're not sure about that. This is why probably we are going to change the reimbursability system. And so you see, it's. I think we have to think differently for the future. Resources are limited, so we have to have studies that hit the endpoint. But the endpoint should also be clinically meaningful and meaningful for the payers, because at the end you can end up with a new anti-mineralocorticoid drug that is great, but will have no market. You can end up with a Plerenone that cannot be reimbursed because it costs 10 times more than potassium carbonate that it's approved of and costs for Europe.
So I'd just like to clarify when I said I don't think imaging is necessarily right for phase two. It's really around the fact that if you're doing dose selection, you're normally looking at small differences between groups. I think it's pretty good for, maybe good for confirming early in phase three where you can test one dose versus placebo. But I'd like to come back to the last set of comments. At some stage, unless we're prepared to say that the practice of medicine in terms of therapeutics halts in 2015 and that we'll never have any drugs better than what we have, it's already getting pretty difficult to do outcome studies with new therapeutics because the absolute event rate is dropping, and 30,000 patients, I think, is becoming the norm, and I think that's probably around the limit. So we're going to have to find ways to sort out what are useful therapeutics and what are not, or else say to ourselves, well, the current state of events is good enough, and I'm afraid that the demographics of the population are going to ruin that strategy because it won't even be as good as it is today as the population rapidly gets away in terms of weight and other risk factors.
On the other hand, if you multiply 160 million euro per 21 countries like in Europe, then that is the budget, the one-year budget, and you can clearly afford doing an event study.
Eric?
We just heard about a lot of drugs where we actually can measure what happens, so LDL lowering for PCSK9 antibody, blood pressure lowering, but what in all these new drugs that were presented, we don't measure or we can't measure what happens locally. So if we then don't use imaging, how do we at all do phase two? Because we can't measure LDL cholesterol if it's not a PCSK9 antibody. So all the anti-inflammatory, et cetera, et cetera.
I can take a shot at that from a sponsor perspective. If I don't have a good surrogate measure that I can do dose selection with, it's got some effect on the directly on the vessel wall. A lot of times we're just not going to progress with that because, you know, taking a risk on a $800 million outcome study as your first definitive evidence of benefit is not attractive. And even doing a $70 million imaging study is also problematical if that's what you're going to use for dose selection.
Bart?
The webcast is working again. We missed one question, so I'll ask it to Robin because there was a question after his talk. And many of the questions coming from Brazil and Argentina are related to application of imaging for patient management versus the discussion of using it as study endpoints. So I guess the conclusion is probably for patient management, it's early days. But the question is the MRI machine used in the studies that you presented the same as the one that is usually used in clinical practice with respect to the magnetic field?
Yes, absolutely. So the studies that I showed today were all done at either 1.5 or 3 Tesla across different platforms. The only specialist kit that you need is specialist neck coils to look at the carotid arteries, but those are easily sourced.
Okay, so that could at least close the gap to a certain extent. And then there's a question also from Brazil, and after the discussion raised by Dr. Tardif, do you think adaptive designs are a good solution for imaging studies? And he's thinking about, how would I say it, statistical approaches, because he's comparing the Bayesian approach to the frequentist approach, but I have to say I'm a little bit out of that area, so I don't know if you understand what exactly the meaning is. It could be that the question is, can we use imaging to adapt a trial once it's already running to sort of re-steer the trial? Do I get that right?
It's a tough question, but that's an interesting one. As far as Bayesian studies are concerned, it seems to me if you want to use imaging in that setting, you would have to use an imaging technique that gives you an early signal, not one like IVUS where you would need to treat patients for 18 months because then there's nothing to adapt. So in that sense, perhaps something like PET with for an anti-inflammatory agent could be built, but I'm not sure that most of these techniques would really be suited. So, you know, I think PET would be another molecular imaging approaches that would give you an early readout could be a way to integrate imaging in adaptive studies. You're going to disagree with me.
No. No, I'm just saying that it's we're still dubious about the possibility of using adaptive trials in for clinical endpoints. And I'll just bring you one clear example. If Boehringer had used an adaptive trial design for the dabigatran protocol, so they probably they would have dropped to the 110 milligrams. And that would have caused a big problem because it's now we know that we can use the two different dosages according to patient characteristics. And you see, that is a case where an adaptive trial design may be more harm than good to a company. And because sometimes companies think at the immediate savings that they can make. They're not thinking at the next 10 years or the next 5 years after the trial has been completed. So I think we still have to think about the applicability of the adaptive trial design for clinical endpoints. And then probably we can move into the imaging. Of course, as you said, it's for the early development, probably that can be used. But I doubt, I'm still a little bit doubtful about the possibility of using it for phase 3 trials.
Wasn't there, well, first of all, the FDA certainly is supportive and have held sessions specifically on that. Wasn't there a company within the last year that successfully used that to develop a device presented their package at FDA, I think,
What I'm saying is different. So I'm saying that if a company, take the example that I've just made. I mean, probably they would have marketed the 150 milligram that works fine.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I see what you mean.
But they would have missed the opportunity of having the 110 on the market, which is, works pretty well, and probably similar to the a comparator, and that it can be used for some patients and with specific indications. So you see, it's sometimes the adaptive trial design may miss some important clinical endpoints, and especially for some subset of patients. And so I think we have to rethink at that. And maybe we can use it in a second confirmatory trial, but for a first pivotal trial, it's difficult to accept the concept.
If I can just add from a sponsor perspective, I agree with what our colleague from I think the regulators, EMA, is saying. I think it's very challenging. While adaptive designs are very sexy and FDA is very keen on them, they're very, very challenging because you basically have to have it set up so that the protocol will go down a decision tree. And it's a little bit like running a computer algorithm. You never have any human intervention, and you have to set this up all a priori. And so you don't have the opportunity to actually look at the data, to think about the data, use some clinical judgment. None of that can be in it. So it may have worked quite well in a device trial. I think some of us within industry are still pretty wary about being able to use it for drug development.
Well, I'd like to thank everybody for their comments and for the participation, and thank you for coming here and adding to this lively debate.